All right, y'all, this is part two. We're just going to jump right in. This is our cold open.
Yeah.
And pause for... This is Be Createful, a podcast about finding fullness through creativity. I'm Joe.
And I'm Madison. And today on episode 89, this is a part two of our cross-cultural creativity. So if you've missed part one, go ahead and go listen to that one and come back here.
And we have with us our cross-cultural creativity, I was going to say expert, but...
Guest.
Guest. That's a good one.
Guest is good.
Rachel.
Hi.
So you should go listen to last week, but if people are like, I don't want to listen to this twice, introduce yourself again.
My name is Rachel Howell, and happy to be here. We lived for, our family lived for 15 years in Mozambique, in Southeast Africa, and so I've spent a lot of time living cross-culturally.
And you are a quilter.
And I'm a quilter.
And I lived in Ireland for 3 years, so... not as long of an experience as Rachel at all, but we're talking, I'm putting in small things too about cross-cultural creativity.
And I'm Madison. I'm just a xenophile that enjoys
I love
different, learning about different cultures and different people. So this is a dream podcast for me. Love it. Okay. So we talked a little bit about Rachel, you talked about the musicality of the language in Mozambique. And Joe, you talked a little bit about how Irish are sort of musical people. I wanted to ask if there was any, if there was anything else that you wanted to share about like the musical or like the music culture in your respective
areas. Rachel talked about storytelling, but I always, this is probably a cultural assumption I'm making about African cultures in general, but I would expect like a level of storytelling or like bards. I don't know if that's what they would call it, but like a musical history, like oral part of their language and storytelling and like songs that get passed down.
Yeah. The storyteller that I talked about in the last episode, bard, is like the best label for,
I didn't know if that was like an English, like a colonized word.
Oh yeah.
A bard.
No, I think that's a great English word for that kind of storyteller and keeper of like communal history, but communal stories. I think music was really important to our Makua friends, and especially generally. So that storyteller, the bard, you know, he was a man. And like the whole culture, I think, loves singing and loves dancing, but women especially are the primary like singers and dancers, and just women love to sing and dance, especially if it involves hanging out with your friends all night long and singing and dancing. And so there's an initiation ceremony for girls when they're transitioning into adulthood. And after we were there for a few years and we were trying to learn, like, what is this ceremony? What does it mean? And what does it mean to people that are participating in it?
Does it happen at a certain age for girls?
Yes. So puberty. And so you're kind of an adult now once you've hit puberty. And so a lot of times it would take place around December or January because that's the school holidays and the planting season. And so families would save up money because it's got to be a big party. And
because for some girls that could be like 11 and for some girls it might be 15.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Exactly. So the longer we were there, the more it started to feel like, it's like, you know, this really kind of feels like just almost like a wedding without the groom. This like launch, you know, into adulthood. The girl would get all the middle-aged and older women in the area, plus relatives from far away would come. And it was about becoming an adult, and they would give all sorts of advice all night long about adulthood as a woman. And sometimes it was great, and sometimes it was, like, not great. And kind of – sometimes there were some elements of hazing involved. It really depended on – whose house you were at and like which family it was. So kind of like a wedding without the groom, but also after a while we're like, this just sometimes also feels like an excuse for like women to just party all night long with their friends.
And it was fun.
Especially if there was some intentionality of like not hazing. And trying to take out any of like the harmful parts of the ceremony. It was an excuse to basically party all night long. So after a lot of years of going to some of these ceremonies, some of our Makua friends, you know, we dance in a circle for hours just singing. And eventually some of them were like, wait, do you have some songs from America? Do you have some dances? And like, that is not my strength. I'm not afraid of dancing and I love to move, but it's definitely not like my strength.
Well,
and
also I don't know that we have, it's not the same either from like what I would think in Africa. Like what kind of dances, like the square dance or like here's how you twerk?
Oh, I was thinking the cha-cha slide or something.
Well, what we did is like started, we were like, well, we can do the electric slide, you know,
yes.
Which for me is pulling back to like the early 90s, you know?
Yes.
And so we would, whenever that question came up, like, show us one of your dances from America.
Or the chicken dance.
Right. We would try and do the electric slide and of course, they just loved that. Anytime it was like, show me a song from your home, show me a dance from your home. It was like cultural exchange. They really
did. They, as far as the music goes, is there they're off key, or is it more just everyone joins in as they're able and has fun, or are they like, this person is a good singer, this person not so much?
No, I think there are definitely like. Some like women in the group are known for like they're really good at this.
Okay,
but it felt like just everybody sang and everybody liked to sing there. But a lot of call and response. So there's a lot of two parts, and a lot of times there would be two people leading a song, and their two parts would be in a really tight harmony that almost sounded like. It was in a minor key, and I don't have all the right music vocabulary to describe this. So two leaders, one a primary leader and another who's got, like, a really tight harmony, and they would, like, lead the first line, and the rest of the group sings the second line as a call and response. And sometimes a lot of songs still were kind of in a major key, but if it was more traditional sounding, it kind of had this, like, I don't know if, like, discordant or, like, minor key is the right word for it, but really beautiful. And sometimes the call and response would be, like, almost every other beat. And it like, created this, like, almost cacophony, but it was very controlled. And, like, we tried to imitate that a few times and just, like, they've been doing it and practicing it and hearing it their whole lives. And, like, I can't go that fast. It was really beautiful. So.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. So how long did it take before you started to get invited to some of these sort of initiations of these young women becoming women?
Pretty early. Pretty early in our time there. People love, where we were living in Mozambique, people loved having guests. They loved having guests. They love having visitors.
It goes back to that whole, like, they love conversation and they love it to have people visiting them.
Right. Hospitality is a huge value and they're just really good at it. And so, pretty early, we were working with some churches while we were there, and some of them were trying to kind of adapt this cultural practice to, like, take out any, like, negative aspects. So, like, let's keep doing this, but let's take out the hazing, you know. I was at one that was just, like, a neighborhood one. I didn't know as very many people there. And, like, there was the hazing almost turned into some, like, push and shove. And so, like, it could, really depending on who you're with, it could get rough. And so, like, no, let's encourage the young woman. Let's take out the intimidation and shame mm-hmm. that usually would come in with this, and make it more like positive and encouraging.
Sometimes I think about sometimes when women get together, we can. Well, and I think this might just be a people issue too. We tend to like complain a lot, or maybe talk a lot of trash about our situation, about like, oh, you know, we kind of like, you know, it's kind of tough to be a woman, I would say. And sometimes we get in groups like that. Was there any element of that to, these gatherings?
That's a great question. I don't think that came up so much. I think it was more like training for like family life and village life and what was expected of women in that society. And so training for like motherhood and marriage and sex and pregnancy and like, but it was also kind of like the birds and the bees talk and like anatomy and puberty and just like every, and again, it really depended on whose family you were with,
sure.
but like everything you need to know about adulthood, you know, in our culture, in our village. And so sometimes it would depend on, you know, which grandmother was talking at the time as like to which version of the advice that you got. And so it was very different. Every single one was different, except for like singing and dancing all night long.
That was the one consistent.
That was definitely consistent.
I like that. Having a good time.
Yeah.
Love it. All right. So what about music in Ireland? You talked a little bit about how pub culture meant that there was a lot of like live music that happened. Did you know a lot of people that maybe, you know, dabbled in instruments or people who enjoyed singing, or what was your experience?
They have a lot of songs that all the Irish people would know. And so like if someone in the pub starts playing that song, then everyone would sing along. Like, I mean, there was for a while a song on Instagram that was really popular in Reels.
Yes.
That was always, so anything that sounds really, I think people would know what I mean when you say
where it's
Irish,
got the, like, consistent,
like really
beat.
Upbeat.
Yeah.
And, yeah. Like it really makes you feel like you could go conquer something or things that are really sad.
Like ballads, like big sad ballads.
Yeah. There's a song called Galway Girl that people would always play. It's so small. The country is so small too. And so they would sing about like certain places.
And so everyone would kind of know about those places. It's that shared cultural identity or shared knowledge.
Kind of like we both grew up in Texas. And so I think Texas has its own culture. If you are not from Texas, you probably are like rolling your eyes like, yeah, they do. Texas is the worst. But like, you know, we would sing The Stars at Night are Big and Bright down
Deep
in the heart of Texas.
Texas.
Like they would just have stuff like that that was
that
Irish.
You just kind of know because you have a strong like cultural identity
with
that. Very cool. But like as far as like instruments are concerned, was there like, oh yeah, everyone kind of like dabbles in guitar, or they,
I don't think everyone really does anything.
Sure.
But yeah, like in America, how you would play the piano.
Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of kids that take piano lessons.
Right. I don't know that. I think that they can play the piano there just because they're musical. Well, so of course they would be taking lessons, but I think, like guitar, they have some of their own instruments, like maybe the lyre. That feels very Irish.
What is a lyre?
It's like, isn't it like a guitar or like more like a banjo, but shaped kind of like a harp.
Okay.
I don't know. It feels very fantasy to me.
But that's different than the thing that's like on Guinness, right? That's actually a harp, right?
Oh, maybe that's a lyre.
I don't know.
Guinness. Oh, no. I think we're, I don't know. Google it.
Google lyre, whatever picture is there, that's it.
Yeah. They had, I want to say that there's like some, like if you listen to Irish music, like the Celtic women or something, mm-hmm. like wind instruments are real, winds, like Inya. Yeah.
Oh,
you know?
Yes.
They've been using Inya in a lot of commercials lately, specifically cheese commercials. And I think that's so strange.
Well, I mean, Ireland has good cheese.
Yeah, it's true.
Is it for what cheese?
I think it's like Kraft cheese. It's not like,
so not like Dubliner cheese.
No, it's not like fancy cheese. Mm. They're like, oh, here's how to get your kids to eat vegetables. And they sprinkle cheese on broccoli and then Enya plays in the background. It's wild.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow. I did have a friend. She was from Germany, but living in Ireland. And she was a cheesemonger. She worked at a cheese shop.
That's so cool.
I love that title. Cheesemonger. I would love to have that title.
It's amazing. I love it. Okay. So we've talked at length about the cultures that y'all have experienced and how they have creativity. We've also talked about how you both individually are creative. So I'm interested to hear if you got to share any of your personal creativity mm-hmm. with the people that you interacted with. So
I think this is what I was the most excited to talk about.
Oh, okay.
You so, go first. Oh.
Me.
Yeah, I meant to hear from Rachel, not me talk about personally.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right. So did you have any opportunities to do that through cooking or music or?
Or you talked about your teammate too, who that was part of the work that she was doing.
Yeah. There is one season where I had a woman working for me in sewing. And so she would like cut the pattern pieces for me, and so that was kind of an early stage for me. As a team, we invested in several different development projects is not the right word, but like development works. And so one of my colleagues started a women's small business like craft training.
I think that's a model that we're familiar with here.
Right.
Because even when I talk about what Make Do is, in people's minds, they think, oh, we're like teaching women coming out of drug rehab right. how to sew bags and then they're going to sell them and make money. It's not sustainable here, but I think it is a sustainable model
right.
where you were at.
And so they were doing jewelry making and sewing, like zipper pouches or aprons or bags.
And then would they sell this stuff there or ship it to the States to sell?
Generally to the States. Yeah. Sometimes our provincial capital was 2.5 hours away, so sometimes stuff could get sold there. There was a little bit of a tourist market there, but I think most of it came back mm-hmm. To the U.S., and that is still happening. They are... the name of it is Urerihana, which means blessing each other, and that is still happening. You can Google them and look them up.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'll get it from awesome, Rachel awesome. And put it in the show notes.
I think I sewed for several people, like if they needed something, like a shirt or a dress or part of their school uniform. Like people would bring me. Little things that they needed help with. And that was something I kind of maintained a little bit on the side. We gave away some quilts while we were there. Sometimes my sewing creativity tended to be a little bit more of my replenishing time at home. And so that's kind of was the space for me. I think a lot of my creativity that was involved, like communal sharing, I think ended up, I could talk about it more in the category of like women's empowerment, which was not on my radar when I went. Never had a class mm-hmm. in high school or college in women's empowerment, right? And so I really feel like I just stumbled into it. We were working with churches, and we had learned. And again, I said this in the first episode, we were in an extremely rural area. We mm-hmm. were in the most remote province. And the years that we were there, at that point, they're really only like 30 to 40 years removed from a pretty awful civil war. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the women that I spent time with were young grandmothers because that's who had time, just a little bit of discretionary time. And not all, but mostly young grandmothers. And most of them, because of like the years and the decades and how far out they were from the war, a lot of times their like formal education had ended somewhere in like elementary school or middle, what you and I would think of as elementary school and middle school.
Yeah.
And so what I felt like I was observing is this lie that women who knew that their formal education had gotten cut short, they thought they were dumb because they weren't as educated as, you know, people from town or, you know. And so, but like what to do in those situations, like that was never part of my training. And so it was, for me, it was very much a learning experience. And so like the availability, to me, this is a huge category of creativity in my story. The availability to realize I don't know everything about this situation, so I'm here to learn. And the availability to realize what's needed in this situation is not something I already have training in. So I'm going to have to not just learn about the situation, but like extend the learning to like, what does this need to look like? And not ever in an individualistic way, in a like collaborative, like group way. We had learned some techniques, some like group study techniques that are easy to reproduce in low-tech environments where there's not just a lot of materials or resources. But not I had not yet learned the version of the everybody is non-literate. Mm. And so that was my first question. How do I do this when nobody can read? Mm-hmm. And because my experience would have been if any printed material came out into the hands of like the one person in the group that could read, you could almost see it on people's faces, like the women, like it almost be like there's like a curtain or a veil that would go down and like their eyes would zone out a little bit. They sometimes when printed materials came out, they would like zone out like this must be above my head. I can't do this. Even though they weren't being required to like read in that moment. It was this oral
like this
version.
Isn't for me. Like this, whatever is on that page is above me anyway.
Even though the practices we were trying to learn together were all oral, audio practices out loud with each other. And so one of the steps in that group experience was something would be read out loud multiple times. And then the question, like, what did you hear? And like at the beginning, there would be all this like embarrassment and like a little bit of shame, and people, they would kind of look down and start mumbling, well, I don't know, I can't. And there's all this I can't. And they'd look down at their lap, or they'd look up, or some of them would just like immediately start giggling, like I'm too embarrassed to. The gift of how time worked there is that there was just no rush. And so I could take all day. And so I learned that I could outweigh there, wherever they learned the shame, like I could outweigh that voice. Mm-hmm. And so within, you know, the first week that we would meet together, it would take reading it out loud, you know, 10 times or 15 times for people to have enough courage to say, well, I heard this, you know. Mm-hmm. And over the weeks and months, that got really short to where we'd only read it out loud two or three times. And, well, I heard this. And, well, I heard this. And Jesus said to love your enemies. Like, who does that? Mm-hmm. And, like that is just, like, provocative. Mm-hmm. No matter what culture you're in, like,
yes,
loving your enemies. Oh, my goodness. And so that was a learning experience for me to realize that it was not just the lack of reading and the lack of formal education, but like the social and emotional negative messages that were attached to that. Well, I didn't get to go past fourth grade in school, so I must not be smart enough to do this or to participate. And it was just like the gift of getting to participate in that slowly over time, like no, you can do this. Like, you know, everybody knows how to share gossip, right?
Yes.
Not that we should be, of course. But no, like, right.
We're somebody good at talking about other people.
Right, somebody reports to you a story. You are perfectly capable of, you know, an hour later reporting the story to the other neighbor. And so, and that's, it was listening and rephrasing. That's basically what we were doing. And everybody's capable of that. And the women I was with were so smart.
Yes.
They were so, you know, they're different kinds of smart. This one's really sarcastic. And this one's like thoughtful and wise. Mm-hmm. And just, they were all extremely intelligent. But so many of them had internalized that message that, like, I'm not smart because I don't have formal education. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of had to learn my way awkwardly into that. I didn't know what tools were out there because I didn't have training in that. But it was really beautiful, and it was a gift, and we learned together through that process. And, you know, the next year I would take a few women from that group, and we would go try and start another group in another village, you know, because I have an aunt over there and that kind of connection. And so we reproduced that in several places. But I think it also gave me eyes or like antenna for like, oh my goodness, like lack of women's empowerment. This is a problem everywhere.
That's what I was going to say, is that in the groups that you're talking about, it's very much tied to education. But I can see the exact same things happening with women, particularly in church conversations here, because it's a similar thing. Like, women don't really get training in matters of spirituality beyond the fourth grade level. And so I think it makes women feel really uncomfortable to pray out loud or to say what they think a passage makes or join means or join in the conversation. I couldn't even tell you how many women have said to me, well, I just don't have anything to say. And I think, but it's only in certain spheres that you don't have anything to say.
Well, I think, Rachel, about what you said earlier about learning the language, and you said that there was that little introverted voice in the back of your head that would say, well, they don't want to know about my mom or like my brother's bike. They don't want to know about me. And to me, that voice is also like the voice of shame. And it was like a similar voice in their head saying, well, I don't have anything to say. They don't want to, you know, I don't have anything to share. And so like you've, their journey almost got to mirror yours as you were trying to learn how to share yourself with their culture. They were trying to learn how to share themselves with each other. And I just think that's so beautiful that you and these women got to grow together in that way. And it goes across those lines of culture of realizing that you are enough and that you are valuable enough to share about yourself and share what you think. And I just... that work that you did was beautiful.
It was so fun, too. it's just really fun to watch women's eyes light up and engage each other. And just, like, the increased confidence over time of, like, realizing that what they think about this matters, that they can have a whole conversation in their group about, like, what did Jesus mean when he said to love your enemies? And the empowerment they get from realizing that their voice matters in that conversation. It was really beautiful to watch. And it was just a lot of fun as well. So
we get to see similar things here through creativity. People just realizing that they're capable. So it's not necessarily that they have something to say or that it's not like a communal conversation, but it's just an internal realization of value when someone thinks that they can't make a quilt and then they do.
I see it a lot in my kids' classes when they go through the scrap bucket and they make something or they invent it. They think they invent a new way of doing something and they share it with their friends, and then their friends want to go and try and make something like that. Like recently, I had a boys-only sewing class, which is very unique in its own right. But the boys found a like discarded skirt that we had put in the scrap bucket because it was like a sample that we just don't use anymore. And they were entirely fascinated by it. And they all decided that they wanted to make their own scrap skirts. And so they just started to try and figure out ways of doing it. And like one would do it this way. And then one would like, oh, well, we can put a drawstring in it. And it was just so interesting to watch them play off of each other in an environment that wasn't judgmental. Because I think especially for boys as they start getting older, like that, you know, 9 and 10, and as they start to get into teenagers, they're very concerned about like performing masculinity in a way that is pleasing to the group.
Right.
And that just wasn't happening here. And they just got to do whatever they wanted and got to play off of each other and just be themselves for a minute. And it was just wonderful.
Well, and they were doing it as a group. Like it was pleasing to the group.
Yes, to that.
And there was a teen. You had
a 13-year-old boy in here. And it kind of makes me sad that kids are growing up so fast, because that 13-year-old boy could totally hang with, like, I had a 7-year-old in the class, and they all got along really well. And it was because I think that 13-year-old was letting go of like having to be that quote teenager,
right,
where they needed to be like over in the corner, kind of like, I'm too cool for all of this. And I wish that there were more opportunities that kids had for that,
So, right. The I'm too cool, so I'm exempting myself will definitely squash creativity really fast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We just think that that's like the adult thing to do, to like go off and be apart and separate and just kind of like, I don't know if it's not engage, but just kind of separate yourself from childish things, which I understand that does have to happen in order for you to grow up. But we separate ourselves from the wrong childish things.
I think there's also some insecurity. We're separating ourselves because of some insecurity too, or like I'm older than all of them. So mm-hmm. It's not like I'm going to go away because I'm cooler. I'm going to go away because I don't feel like I fit
belong.
In. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyways, well, I didn't expect to hear all about that group from you, Rachel. I think that's absolutely beautiful and wonderful. Joe, I know that you had, if anyone knows anything about Make Do, that you then you know that you had a similar kind of women's group that helped to inspire Make Do in the way
yes, but also when I was in Ireland, and they weren't women, they were, they were women,
younger.
But
they were of the female persuasion.
Yeah. So that story you can hear in depth probably in episode 1, but I will retell it here. It wasn't coming from, I stumbled into it. It wasn't I worked with a youth camp in the summers, and the second summer that I did it, I was given the difficult girls in my tent, and one of them had shaved another girl's eyebrow off while she was sleeping the year before.
That's pretty difficult.
Yeah, it's kind of scary too. I didn't want to wake up with only one eyebrow. Anyway, at the end of camp, they asked if I would be their counselor next year. And when I said yes, they answered with a sense of shock. And they were expecting me to say no. They said, no one ever wants us. And so when I showed that I valued like being around them, they asked if they could come stay with me in Dublin. And so I said yes, because I thought that they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would have said yes, even if I thought they would, but
I think we've all been down that road where we're like, oh, you live way too far away.
Yeah, sure.
You can come stay at my house at any time. And then they give you that call.
Yeah. I mean, by the time I got home, so they only had, you know, an hour and a half trip home, and I had a much longer trip home to Dublin. By the time I got there, I already had Facebook messages from them. Also, this was back when Facebook was cool for teenagers.
Right.
Not anymore. So they came and stayed with me on an open-ended train ticket. And one of the things I made them do, just so that they would quit being hoodlums causing trouble, was sew pillow covers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw them go through the entire creative process. Like, being overwhelmed by all the options that they had, picking out what they liked, but then looking at their friend and saying, what do you think about this? You know, like not really trusting what they had picked themselves. Mm-hmm. And then technically they learned a new skill that mm-hmm. they had never done before, which means you mess up because when you're a beginner of anything, you make mistakes. So then they got really familiar with the seam ripper. And they, by the end of the day, had a pillow that they had finished. Mm-hmm. I sewed the zippers. They zipped and I did that part for them. I thought that that would maybe put me over the edge, I would say, mm-hmm. to teach them how to do that. But, and so then we took pictures and they posted it on Facebook and we spent the whole evening of them counting all the likes and reading all the comments, and they value got reflected onto them. So like a few weeks before at camp, they had this notion that no one ever wants them. Like that was the truth that they operated from. And then now they had this new experience where people were seeing value and appreciating something that they had made. And so I think it really shook them mm-hmm. up a little bit. And it definitely was the first, and this could happen in any culture. This wasn't like this only worked mm-hmm. because I was in another culture, but it was the first time that I realized creativity wasn't just a hobby or like, you know, some people enjoy reading and some people don't, and that's fine. Creativity isn't like that. Creativity is accessible to everyone and it has value.
That goes beyond just spending time.
Yeah, it has like deep soul mm-hmm. value for us. Just like eating healthy or exercising is good for your body. Like mm-hmm. creativity, being creative, is good for our souls. So that was where the idea for Make Do came from. And while I was there, so that was about halfway through my time in Ireland. And so I found an organization called Ruhama, which is an Irish word for now. I don't remember what it means. Anyway, they worked with women who were impacted by prostitution. And mm-hmm. so most of them had been trafficked into Ireland from either Eastern Europe or Northern Africa. Mm. And they have all kinds of services for these women, helping them legally. You know, like a lot of them were undocumented because their papers were taken by whoever trafficked them in. So, you know, they worked with lawyers in Ireland. They call them solicitors. Mm, yes. They worked with lawyers to just help them navigate immigration. They worked with housing and, you know, everything that they needed. They had those services. But I went in once a week and taught sewing. And so they had maybe like 5 sewing machines that had been donated. They were all different. So this mm-hmm. is when I was like, if Make Do, well, it didn't have a name then,
yeah.
but we will have all the same sewing machines. Like I didn't really know, you know, one would not be working and I wouldn't know how to fix it. And mm-hmm. So anyway, I dreaded going every week because I always felt like, how am I really going to be able to impact these women? I was so overwhelmed by like knowing what their circumstance was. And it took a few weeks of me going to be like, it's not my job to fix their circumstance. Like, mm-hmm. how would I teach my mom's friend how to sew mm-hmm. or like my own friend how to sew? Or why am I like becoming so tongue-tied and speechless around these women because I feel sorry for them? And so it was another realization that creativity is just a levelizer. It's like it makes everything an equal playing field. It doesn't mm-hmm. matter what they were coming from that day or where they slept the night before, or, you know, I didn't have to like judge their situation. I wasn't trying to save them from anything. I just was teaching them how to sew like I would teach anyone mm-hmm. how to sew. And then I had some women who would come like often, And then some people would just jump in for one class. It was, I think that also was why it was stressful for me, because I never knew how many would right. come, if any. It wasn't easy to get to. Like, I had to, there were no buses that went there, so I had to walk. So if the weather was like bad at all, I wouldn't want to go. And anyway, there was a lot of unknowns week to week, but eventually I became more comfortable with the unknowns. And I would try to do projects that would just take one time. And I'm trying to remember where we got fabric from. I maybe like took a bunch of fabric up there one time, and I don't think I was carting, like carrying supplies back and forth with me. And then we just kind of kept it in a closet. But eventually I was like, wait a minute, all these women who are coming from Africa, they maybe have had experience with the sewing machine before. And I'm sitting here acting like I need to teach them everything. So then it became a way for them to share knowledge that they already had. And us, it kind of was a back and forth of, well, this is what I know or how I do it. And my way was a lot more, I don't want to say educated. That's not what I mean. But like,
it was more what school
would,
form.
Yes, right? What you would learn in school on this is right. And like, this is how you would do it versus like, here's the steps and the order and versus their way. Kind of like Rachel in last week, well, previously, you were talking about how the women would just tuck, like it was just layers of fabric, and they would do like some weird, intricate tuck for how they would wear their skirts.
And they would always stay up. They wouldn't fall down.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, they had more things like that. Like, they didn't really measure. They would just,
they're like, just about this much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was really a way for me to continue learning what creativity as community building looks like. Mm-hmm. I did a couple of things with churches, like ladies' days, where I would lead them through craft. And so I had to learn how to scale it up. So like, if you have 20 people, we're not sewing, what are we doing? And how are you walking people who don't think that they're creative through a process that is creative? So
it sounds like really highly participatory. Like there's a give and take and a back and forth, and
yes, but also no, well, it's not collaborative, but and participation can be, this is what I like about creativity as a way to build community. I think it's similar to like playing games. When we're teaching a class here at Make Do, or if I was leading people through something in Ireland, you can sit with your own work, your own hand embroidery piece, and you don't have to actually join the group at all, but you're still with the group. Right. And you're still like in proximity to the group.
You're at the table.
Right. And then it lets people join the conversation when they're ready. We were talking in the previous episode about small talk in Mozambique, and that was something you had to learn. I hate trying to come up with conversation. And if you're just sitting there staring at someone, it feels really awkward. But having something creative in front of you, even if it's like a coloring book, it doesn't even have to be, just having something else to do lets you ebb and flow with conversation in a way that doesn't feel so awkward. And what I find is that people will actually have more difficult conversations. They'll go beyond the small talk accidentally, because they're not looking right at someone, and it lets you be more vulnerable with your experiences, because you have this not barrier, but this distraction. So you're not having to like look at someone as you say something that might feel vulnerable.
There's been some research on people having conversations while they're taking walks versus sitting down, and you're more likely to have a more truthful, authentic conversation if you are walking with someone than say if you were just sitting down. And I think you could replace walking with...
Or driving. That's another thing. Like mm-hmm. when you're driving in the car, you may be surprised at what kind of conversations you have, but it's because mm-hmm. you're looking forward. You're not looking at each other.
It takes that pressure off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago now, talked about loneliness mm-hmm. and connection. And so I'm sure this is something that we touched on there, but being creative. And you said, even in what would be now last week's episode, that the creativity we do here in the States can feel quite isolating, like mm-hmm. sewing, painting. It feels like it's something that we're doing on our own. Mm-hmm. But I think it also creates an opportunity to do that thing alongside someone else, where you can be with someone but not have to be doing something together. You can be together without having to work on the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's like when kids parallel play.
Right.
And it just creates an opportunity for
you can
for
make
connection.
It, you can make it into what you need it to be mm-hmm. at that time.
Yeah. So would there be anything, Rachel, in Mozambique, like, you know, we think about, oh, the old quilting circles or just women sitting around and doing something. Even I think of like shucking beans on your
exactly.
porch. Like, were there those opportunities in Mozambique?
Yeah. And I think like shucking beans is like the best example. Like meal prep was all done by hand. And so you might have to be peeling the beans out of the pods or stripping the veins from the pumpkin leaves in prep for cutting the tomatoes, cutting the onions. It was very much a communal activity. Somebody's a few feet away, like trying to build up the fire and start the water boiling for the like the porridge mush.
So would that be something that was happening within each household or among the village?
Definitely just within each household. Okay. And then like if we were visiting on a Sunday, then it was more of a communal effort where several family units will have brought, you know, one person brought the beans and one person brought the tomatoes and one person brought the corn flour, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And they're using whoever's like fire pit is closest to the church building or the like gazebo type structure that they were worshiping together in. And so very much a group project and, you know, involving like, wait, who's bringing the onions? We don't have any onions. Who was supposed to do that? You know,
mm-hmm.
Taking turns, in the meal prep. And it was very much a like group activity and they made it look so easy. but like stirring the cornmeal, they were so strong. In their arms were so strong from mm-hmm. a lifetime of doing that work that sometimes we'd have visitors who would it was very much a like, hey, can I come in the kitchen and learn? Mm-hmm. And they made it look so easy that sometimes like a visitor would say, can I take a turn stirring the cornmeal, like the porridge?
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Shima. And it was always really funny to watch like a college student visitor like take a hold of the giant spoon mm-hmm. and just like immediately come to a stop, like because they couldn't stir it because they weren't strong enough, and just to realize how much work was going into it.
Yes.
And that also was where a lot of important conversations happened mm-hmm. too, as women.
And would that be pretty? Would that be like only women do the meal prep?
Yeah, a lot of the time it was not like. It wasn't necessarily shocking or weird for men to step in. Like, definitely we had a few, like, women's events.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times for those, like, the men in the community would be the one. And we're going to, like, cook and do all the dishes for this, like,
well, women are
event.
Doing something else. Yeah.
But they did have some pretty – they did have categories for, like, who is supposed to do what. You know, even, like – in the house building, like women would do the mudding of the walls, but only men would do the roofs.
Mm.
And, like in meal prep, a lot of those tasks fell to women, but only men were supposed to slaughter an animal, like if there was a chicken in your meal. And so I'm sure I didn't finish learning all of
those
categories. But one of my friends, I told her that like, Yeah, where I'm from in the United States, a man or a woman could kill the chicken. And she mm-hmm. laughed so hard, like she was, like you and I would expect someone to laugh like for a stand-up comedian. Like oh. it was so funny to her that like women can do that too. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Different universe.
Uh-huh. I love it. Well, we're kind of reaching the end of our time here. So I wanted to thank Rachel for sharing with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to go into a little bit of our typical ending for our podcast. But I think the takeaway here is that even though there are, you know, that we can be vastly different in our cultures around the world, that each of us have a desire to be seen and heard, and that creativity and the way that it expresses itself can be a great way in order for us to share ourselves with each other.
I think it can be, like Rachel was obviously in a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
Like the people didn't look like you. The language was different. The lifestyle was different. In Ireland, it was like close enough that I would forget. And so then it would just be, there would just be times that were shocking. Like, oh, wait, yeah, I'm in a different country, mm-hmm. in a different culture. And I think even here, like individually, that happens too, right?
Yes.
Like I have my own little culture inside of my brain and my body and the way that I think. And so we're never really as homogenous as we are expecting to be. And so I think that the ways that Rachel and I were able to use creativity to build connections cross-culturally still apply here. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's almost, you have to be more intentional because there can be that illusion of,
they're well, coming these, from the same place
yeah.
that I am. They understand.
Right. It's and harder like to make the to make that move to like an adjacent culture than it is to leap, you know, across an
yes,
ocean.
Because you went, you knew that you had to learn mm-hmm. that culture.
Right.
And so you did not make as many assumptions because everything was obviously so different. And that might be one of the reasons why we can get so frustrated within our own culture and our own community, because we're, those assumptions just come so naturally that we don't even realize that we are making them.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully hearing our experiences in different cultures, whether slightly different or obviously different, are helpful for like how we navigate day to day running into other people here.
Absolutely. All right. Let's move into the little bit more fun part, the end of our little podcast. Let's talk about our sweet and sour.
You go first because you haven't got to talk very much.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, I can totally go. So I'll do my sweet first. So last 2 weeks ago now, I talked about how I was really upset with a dress that I was making.
Yeah, it was your sour a few weeks
ago.
It
was my sour. Yeah. I was like, it's giving clown right now and I cannot have that. And I was just feeling really stuck. Well, today I'm wearing the dress and
it's amazing.
Yeah. And it's a, thank you. Rachel is clapping. I appreciate that. And it turned out really well. I thought I needed a collar and what I needed instead was a nice little V-neck. So I'm feeling good about it now.
I can say this is what I was expecting. And I think, I don't remember what episode it was, but I'm pretty sure I was like, I don't believe you that it looks clown. And I'm just going to say I was right.
Yeah.
It looks incredible.
To me, like just the way it was all working, I was like, this is not giving the vibes mm-hmm. that I need. And so I was,
and your balloon sleeves, I don't know if that's what you call them.
Yeah, I don't
maybe
know
that does sound clown to have yeah. balloon sleeves, but they're so cool.
Yes. They're a 1930s, puffy sleeve pattern. I love them. And I had a lot of people, like when I told them, oh yeah, I made the dress. They're like, you what? Which I don't get that very often. Cause normally I make things out of really strange fabric or patterns that they're like, only you could have made
like
that.
Really
like really
bold that. And floral. And,
yes.
Yeah.
But this one, they thought I bought it somewhere. So that was really
cool. Is the skirt lined? I just noticed that.
Only the bottom is lined. This is a historical
It's just like a hem.
Yes, it's a historical technique to have about 5 inches of fabric sewn as the hem of your dress. It provides stabilization and it allows you to keep the length of your dress. So
and it like adds some weight, I would think, to
exactly.
help pull it down.
Yeah.
Well, it looks great.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. All right.
Go, Rachel.
Yeah. What do you have something sweet that has happened to you?
I have a sweet. I heard a story told recently at a family gathering. And so this is not my story, mm-hmm. but I heard a story told about, this is one of my husband's cousins, and telling a story about one of their other uncles. They had been in Nashville, and the cousin had gone into downtown Nashville with his coworkers for part of their job that day. And apparently this other uncle was a bus driver for Metro Nashville.
Okay.
And this is an uncle he didn't necessarily see every week or every month or anything. And so he's like crossing the street in downtown Nashville with his coworkers.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the, I guess, he didn't say, I was trying to picture it in my mind. I'm picturing like a crosswalk and they must have gotten the green guy. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Turned across the street. And so this bus pulls up and the bus is stopping like it should. But then all of a sudden there's a big blast from the horn. And so they all look and it's
his
uncle Bruce.
Oh.
But the sweetness in the story was like there was a crowd of people crossing the street. And so it must have been that the uncle wasn't sure that the grown nephew would see like this is.
Yes. Right.
And so the uncle starts like waving and then like blowing kisses through the windshield and like doing air hugs to make sure that they made eye contact so you could see who it was and why he was greeting him. And so the nephew is also returning the kisses and he's like in a crowd of his coworkers. And it was just the sweetest story.
That is sweet.
And I just felt like I got a gift in getting to hear that sweet story.
That is really sweet. Yeah. Love that. Thank you for sharing with us.
And so the nephew was visiting Nashville? Or he lived there?
I think outside of Nashville.
Okay.
And so I don't think...
I guess, is it a common thing that he is in Nashville walking on the street?
Yeah.
There was a couple times that I would... Maybe once that I actually saw someone I knew when I was in Ireland. And I was like, whoa, what? It's like a double take, you know, someone from the States. And then there were sometimes when I would see someone had posted on Facebook... And I'll be like, looks like they're in Dublin. And then, okay. My sweet is that I finished my book.
Oh,
the last of the Throne of Glass series. There were 7 books. I think altogether it's like 6,000 pages or something.
Oh.
And I finished the last one yesterday.
How do you feel?
Well, that's my sour, is that I finished my book.
Oh. So you feel sad that you're done with that series.
Yeah, even though I like... It was a real 100 pages shorter.
Mm. Like maybe edited better.
And like,
yeah.
But, and you know, of course there was things I wouldn't have written it like this, but that's life. I mean, I wouldn't make a lot of the choices that real people make either. So that's fine. But it's sad.
The ending is sad?
No, the ending's not sad. But something being over is sad.
It is.
And so even though I was ready to be done and move on with the next thing, I've also just spent like 8 weeks with these characters. And so I was a little bummed. So I had to start my book club book immediately.
To kind of like help fill that space.
Yeah, to like help me be like, these are not real people. It's okay that this is over.
Yeah, that's fair.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to, like, go into a different world. That world was not real, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll share my sour. I am very tired from a weekend wedding that I went to, and I'm afraid that it's going to take me yet another night's sleep to, like, fully become rested. Like, I tried sleeping on the drive on the way home, and I am just so worn out. Mm-hmm. It was a full day. Like, I got up at 7 a.m. the morning of the wedding, and then we were not really done with, like, the socializing and everything until about 10:30 at night.
That's a long day.
Yeah, and there was a lot of, like, picking up things and, like, making sure that things got done and everyone is happy and all of that. And, yeah, I am just definitely worn out. So that's my sour.
Yeah.
So. I think my sour, we have teenagers, and that's not the sour, but like they are delightful.
Yeah.
we are in the middle of just like learning how to make choices with time.
Time and, management.
Well, and some of it is like them learning to make choices that eventually mean that they can't say yes to everything that sounds interesting.
Yes.
And so it's just hard to, you know, rules is not how people learn, at least not past the first few years, right? So it needs to be experiential learning of if I say yes to this many things, this is how I'm going to feel and how much energy I will have left. And that experiential knowledge will stick longer than just like the parents just deciding, you know?
Yeah.
So
like when they come to ask you like, oh, can I do this? Instead of being like, no, that's too much. You're like, all right, well, let's see how this goes.
Right. And let's talk about how many hours you feel like the other things you're already involved in will take. So some of those conversations have been hard lately. Not awful, just challenging.
Yeah, I get that. It can be really tough to try and tell someone like, look, I want to be able to give you all of the good things and have you experience all of these great things, but you're a human being with limitations. And that's tough to realize.
Right.
All right. Hey, Joe, what you learning this week?
So this week in particular, I think last week, well, not last week because we didn't do this. The last time that we did this, I think what I was learning was how to invest in myself.
Okay.
Do you remember us having that conversation?
It's been a little bit. I've had a bit of a weekend.
Well, so if you don't remember, then people listening might not remember either.
Well,
so
I wasn't here.
So. I bought like a course for end of year fundraising and just instead of trying to say I can figure this out for free or bootstrap my way through it, learning that I can put money into myself. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so that was what I was learning a few weeks ago. And then now I'm actually going through that course. So I'm learning how to do an end of year fundraising campaign.
And you did that by buying this course and like being like, this is money well spent.
Yeah. So I guess a couple of weeks ago, what I was learning was a little bit more abstract, like how to actually, you know, be okay spending money on investing in myself. And then now it's the actual learning.
How do we do the
what I spent the money on. So
I get that.
What are you learning?
I am learning. Oh, recently I watched a video on like Renaissance fairs. Mm-hmm. I've been to only one in my lifetime, but apparently there's like a whole discourse about historical accuracy at Ren fairs. And if you are not part of that culture, it's similar to when I've talked about Comic-Con. People go in costume to basically an outdoor venue where they have all of this, all of these like things set up to be like a Renaissance village, but it has a lot of like fantasy and strange elements. So you see someone like in a full like chemise and kirtle looking like an actual like period person from the Renaissance. And then you've also got a chick with like fairy wings and elf ears walking around doing her thing. So I learned a little bit about that. But I also learned that I'm learning that people like actually are starting to like appreciate what I make, like with this very dress that I'm talking about that I talked about earlier. I went to this was the dress that I wore to the rehearsal dinner. And I just always assume that when I wear something that is what I consider to be very loud or different, they just assume that I make it. Mm. That they're like, oh, it's weird and different, so therefore you made it. So then to have people come up to me and say, I really like your dress, you know, where'd you get it? And I'm like, oh, I made it. To have that kind of shock come across their face, I'm like, oh, yeah, I don't make things that are just weird. Like sometimes people just appreciate them and want a little piece of that.
But also that dress you're wearing looks like something you could get at Madewell.
Yeah, probably.
Or Able. Like it looks very on trend and
Yes. Which I don't typically make things that are on trend, which I guess is why it's so strange for me. Yeah. I'm not used to people being in the mainstream appreciating what I do. And sometimes that can be kind of weird for my self-esteem because I'm like, if people don't like what I make, oh, well, it's because I'm weird and different. But now that people are appreciating the things that I make, it feels like, oh, wait, maybe I'm not as weird and different as I thought I was. Yeah. So, yeah. cool stuff.
Or maybe your weird and different is just in the same Venn diagram.
Yeah, it's like overlapped with some other things. Yeah, that's true. Anyways, Rachel, what are you learning this week?
I'm learning lots of things all the time because learning is like probably my primary hobby.
Yeah.
Love learning. But I took an online writing course recently. And one of the things I'm doing in this season is like setting up a website to start writing and to start doing it, like give it a lot of time to it. So, I'm definitely in the beginning stages of what this is supposed to look like and how it's all supposed to fit together. So, yeah.
That's exciting. And also very brave of you to put, again, a piece of yourself, like, because whenever you write or you're creating something, that's a little piece of yourself out there for people to see on a website.
Right.
Very proud of you.
Thanks.
Good work. All right. We've talked for quite a while. It's been fun. Rachel, thank you for being here.
For
thank
so
you
long.
For having me.
We probably roped you into much longer than you were expecting.
This is so fun.
Yes. We appreciate you. Mm-hmm. And anyways, thank you for listening at home. We appreciate you too.
Next week, y'all. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to my dear, dear friend Craig Hudson for our very createful theme music. You can hear more of Craig's music on Spotify under Craig Hudson, that's Hudson with a T, or you can just click on the link in the show notes. Also, be sure to connect with Make Do on Instagram at Make Do Create or on Facebook at Make Do Cersei. And visit our website, makedocreate.org, for upcoming classes, show notes, to order a face mask, lots of things. We'll be back here with another episode next Monday. Have a good week, y'all.